Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity. You're about to listen to the second part of Articulating the Clandestine Experience, Literary and Refugee Voices. The seminar was a part of the Work in Progress series.
I would like to ask you something. Maybe would you, if you could tell us how it was before the war, maybe the beautiful things, the little things that made life very nice before the war, what it was like.
Is before the war, the country had peace. We had a normal life. Children, they are going to school. Adults, they are going to university. And life was normal. Anyway, that the economic problem is still was there, but not like now, after the war. Before the war, the problem, economic problem was there. But it was acceptable that people they are managing to live and trying to do something like for your family, for your relative, things like that. But just after the war, a lot of things changed. A lot of things changed. And life become really rough. And I can tell you, it spent me some time to talk like this, that you can imagine at home, people just can take mice, the mice, seed of maize, they grind it to powder. Now they just make like something like that, they cook it and put salt, then sugar, no milk, and just take it like that for all the day and sleep. For all the day and sleep. Because after the war, the condition now, it's so rough that there are some of the people even, they are not resisting even because of that. That's how can I live like this? Okay, let me try to go away. But before, it was not much easy also, but people were trying to survive on the better way they can. But since problems start, and everywhere problems, everywhere fire, everywhere this, and no way again. That's why it's bringing a lot of problems. That I'm telling you, there are a lot of people. I used to try to phone, because they used to tell me that, okay, try to contact people, that's okay, like you can have maybe some rights to talk to them. I used to try to talk to them. But they used to insult me on the phone. They're still preparing to come anyway.
Hi, if I may ask, during your transition from Congo to the shore, during your cross country, did you travel at night or during the day? And did you ever see any soldiers, and were there any roadblocks?
Yes, I wasn't brief on my experience, but it was too much long to talk. It would take long, but in brief, like from your question, it's not easy also to cross borders when you are coming. You find police, they are secured, they are keeping the border, so you have to give them some money. They know people, they are running anywhere, everywhere people they are running, and they are corrupt people. When you are coming, even you arrive with your visa, they will just tell you, do you have a drink? So, no matter to present your passport or what, they don't need it. But most of the journey was in the night, because it looks a bit safe on the night than the day, because in the day is too much problem. On the night you can hide yourself somewhere and just cross around and you reach other side than on the day. On the day they will see you quickly. But it's not easy to cross the border. But they know people are coming to cross, and you prepare also some of the money with you in your pocket. Just when you come, you are coming one. The motor will stop there. You're coming one by one. You just put some things in your hand. When just you come, you just give them. They will not even count it. You just give like that. It will okay. Pass. Till finish. They come to check the motor. If no one hidden himself in there. They just check. Okay. All right. The driver. Move on. And you come. You collect again your people. You continue the road.
Can I just add that we're talking about a Germany that normally takes between 1 year and 2 years?
Sorry.
I mean, many of the people I have spoken to, at least, mm-hmm. have taken at least 1 year or 2 years to get from their country of origin to Malta.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not talking weeks, we're talking at least 1 or 2 years, at least the people I know.
Norbert's talk contained a number of harsh phrases, a number of very memorable phrases. So I'm not going to ask Norbert about his own talk because the ideas were extremely clear and well argued. But I'm going to try to, as it were, engage Norbert with Popol for a minute. Norbert, Popol has presented a story which is really rather unrepeatable. But what does come out of the story is loneliness, is obliviousness, is continuous travel, is continuous movement. Purely by way of an experiment, may I ask you, does that speak at all to the thoughts which go through your mind when you talk about a Maltese literature that would be rootless, that would be about obliviousness, that would be about not mattering? That's the only way I can put it. I hope you understand my question.
Okay, no, I think, well, the only way I can explain this is by, as I argued in the last bit, it's very difficult for me to hear an experience like Popol's and thousands of other people and manage to relate it related to some sort of mission of literature. Okay, it is definitely not the mission of literature to do that. Okay, we can interpret ruthlessness, aggressivity, as it were, because somehow you need to have an act of aggression if you want to penetrate a place, if you want to penetrate another place, if you want to penetrate a market, if you want to penetrate a readership. But ultimately, even this literature, whether it be, as it were, sheepish or whether it be aggressive, it cannot take it up to itself to narrate this kind of experience. So much so that if you take Mediterranean, what we can bluntly call Mediterranean writing today, that's trying to penetrate these foreign markets and trying to make it to the big guys in London, it does narrate the experience of immigration somehow. It does somehow try to narrate the experience of asylum seeking, but it has never ever ventured to narrate the clandestine experience. That is the terrible experience that Popol has just narrated of him being on the ship, which is, I believe, the worst. I don't know whether Popol has anything to say about this. It is the worst of moments. So there you are. The experience of literature itself is an answer. It has, as far as I know, I haven't ever come across a novel, even I dare say a poem, that really addresses this very moment. I don't know whether I answered.
Well, there seems to be a question that I want to ask, but I don't know exactly what it is. You you have gone through an experience which is terrible there, and you have faced things which none of us, I'm sure, in this room have faced in quite those terrible forms. Is there anything you can tell us about your evaluation of this? What do you make of human nature after having experienced this evil? I'm not sure whether I'm asking the right question here, because when a person is writing or when a person is living, the core is that he or she is not he or she, but is a refugee. So they're as human beings, we're all facing a sort of something that seems as dark as what you have been speaking about. And yet, very often you read literature and you know that the writer or even the reader is really turning their face away from this. But it seems as if the thing was sort of brought to your attention even without you wanting it there, and you couldn't avert your eyes. What did you really see?
I don't know if I really understood your question. I mean, you're asking me what can I say about, like my opinion after having all this experience, or?
Kind of your, now that you've gone through and you're still going through this experience, uh-huh. And what does this experience, this difficult experience, make you think about people, about life, about mm-hmm. human beings?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yes, actually, like Kami and Morza, I was hearing Norbert reading. It's nice what he's writing down, but like parent or future parent, some they are really parents, some they will be future parent. I want to say this, you know, that when you are neighbors, you know, two house neighbors, and you see another parent is beating his child, and you heard a child crying, like a parent to another side, you feel somehow that you like to come to ask what's going on. Why are you beating your child? And I think, like a parent, you take the child from his own parent to keep him first, and then talk with the parent. That's what's going on. You tell not my son, they like, but yes, you cannot beat like this. You try to talk to him, to bring him down, to cool him down. Then later, you will take the child, you bring it back home to his parents. It's what I will say for Europe and the human rights should do. I would talk Europe like a parent and Africa like a parent. The parent from Africa is beating his child. So, you're European, what should you do? Come. Take first that child, bring it with you, keep him for a while of time, and discuss with Africa, the leaders. That's what's going on. You're seeing a merging of people coming in Europe. Your child are running from your house. What is going on? And you make something down the table, then later you take the child, you bring it back home. It's what Europe can do. First, welcome a child who is running away from the trouble from his family. Welcome him first. Don't look after maybe what he did, or maybe he did something wrong to his parent. welcome him first and know what is his problem. Know the first aid you can get to him. Not that you make him rich, because you have your own family, you have your own children. Your first aid you're going to do is not that you make him rich, just to have him met first for the first time. Then you will know later what to do. If peace returns back, I know those people, they are protecting temporary, they will go back. They will not run from the police. When you meet on the road, your passport, they look, now but you have to go back. They will take you. They will check if there is everything is okay for your country. Like United Nations, they used to say like that. That's all those people when we are receiving, just to keep them for a while time. When there will be peace, we have to send them back. But still now, the peace is not yet. That's why they are still keeping people. But the first things I'm asking for Europe, or for European, welcome. This is the first things for us to do. Just welcome them first and ask what is their problem. Like a parent, a neighbor parent. Is what I'll try to let know a bit about us as well.
Okay, basically I'd like to draw attention to a small detail, as it were, connected to what Paul is saying. We also have to remember that the atrocities being done in these countries are being narrated by people who can write, and who can write good writing, good literature, good journalism. They are being narrated, but as you must know, these people are being themselves tortured, thrown out of the country. The atrocities are happening on these people themselves. So sometimes I don't want us to get away with the impression that people, I don't know, that good writers move to Paris or move to London just because they are good writers. Sometimes they have to move out because they are simply thrown out of the place, like what's happening today in Saudi Arabia. Okay, we might feel that Saudi Arabia is somehow the blue-eyed child of the Arab world, but ultimately many atrocities are taking place, and the writers over there are not allowed. They are not allowed to publish their works. So there's clandestinity in this sense, that even places like Libya, despite what's happening now and the sort of good turn of Gaddafi, it does not spell out the same destiny as the Libyan writers go through. These people are still being tortured. I mean, we can think of another African writer, Wole Soyinka, during the war, the Nigerian war. If you are found with a picture, even a picture of Soyinka, in your pocket, you'd get killed immediately. So that's it. I basically wanted to draw attention to this fact.
One thing I always sort of wonder about is people like you met on the when you were on your trip to the coast. I mean, are people, some of the people who are fleeing their countries, considering staying in other countries in Africa, or do most of them try to reach Europe? Or do they feel they wouldn't be safe if they stay somewhere in Africa in another different country? Would they be safe there? Or would there be such close family ties, or hearing from other, you know, through the grapevine that they're there and they would be in danger of being killed even if they're in another country? How is that? I mean, how is your experience?
Yeah, there are some of the people, like, I've tried to ask some question direct like this to them. Ask them why you did not stay in Libya. Like some of, say, why you did not stay in Libya? Because Libya looks a bit fine, and there is no war there. And there are some people say that before come here, I had a small job, which gave me some money to cross the sea. Some say, but why didn't stay and continue to that job and survive there? Some of them say, like, you don't know Libya. There is racism, too much there in Libya. Too much racism. There is not human right. You cannot claim your right for anything. So how can I live to a country without human right? I mean, I will look like an animal. But any time they can take me and do anything they want on me. So that's the reason I left that country. But for other things, it's a good country. I had my job and I was renting my place myself. I was surviving the most good I can. But I didn't find a woman right there that pushed me to leave the country and to look for a way I can find a human right place, I mean, something like that.
But did you ever have the feeling they would find you out from Congo, that they would follow you to other countries and try to find you?
Repeat again your question, who?
Did you ever have the feeling that they were trying to find you, I mean, whoever they were from the, you know, from Congo trying to find you in another country to kill you, or there wasn't any chance in that respect?
I don't get really your question.
Were you afraid that, for example, in Sudan, that the people from Congo would come to look for you in Sudan and to kill you there? To arrest you over there?
Yes, that point also is, it's one of the points that, yeah, it's right. Let's say, for example, when I reach in Malta, some of the friends from Congo, they will look at after me. Hey, look, your mother's side, they are the one who's destroying the country. You are lucky like we are here. If not, that they can push at us, you should have a problem. And it's true. That if human rights was not here, now, or the law that you do something wrong, they'll give you the cost. Now, something wrong should happen to me as well. And it's true, because they know. That's how. We know that your mother was from the country they are fighting our country. And secondly, your parents, they destroyed the country. And you are coming in to stay here with us. And I don't use really to stay with them. I use most to stay alone, just to avoid problem. Anyway, we are here. They are protecting all of us. But between us, something can happen. That's why I'm just trying to avoid them and stay to my side.
I must tell another story. We both have a common friend from Congo who spent 1 year in a family in Sudan, and they hosted him for a whole year, and he lived with them, and it was no longer possible to stay with them after that because they themselves were very poor. But I think statistically it has been shown time and again that most African refugees actually are refugees in other African countries. I think it's the great majority. Not just the majority, but as far as I know, it's the great majority.
Yeah. My question surrounds your project, the clandestine project, which is basically emerging Mediterranean writers. The word has political connotations, which means a minority, whether racial, religious, ethical, whatever. Now, as Maltese writers, immigration, refugeehood, statelessness, it's not a new phenomenon in the Middle, you know, in the Middle East or the Mediterranean. And the most beautiful writings have been written about Lebanese going in the 17th century through Brazil, Libyans being thrown by the Italians to Lampedusa, etc., etc. Now, because of the Maltese nature and the kind of isolation, the economic, psychological, and social, isn't this phenomena affecting you as writers as such? And I think this was the question that Paul asked. I mean, how could you be, I mean, you don't have to write about them because they have their own writers, Tahar Ben Jalloud, whatever. But how is it affecting this project? How is it affecting your productivity and your outlook?
Okay, so basically there have always been these sentiments in the projects that, well, should this clandestine project, should this coterie of writers be writing about these issues? Or should we interpret our clandestinity in other terms? I've restricted most of my paper to these other terms, the literary terms. Basically, I have no qualms about that. I mean, people, well, can take up these issues, but I feel it's, I think most of us apparently feel it's a bit too presumptuous, sort of, to write directly. We can write about our experience of clandestini coming to Malta. In fact, Claire, I think, is writing something about that, about clandestini that coming to Malta. That's a direct experience that we have. We can, certainly, and we are writing about that. But ultimately, I still feel it will be a very superficial venture to try to delve, really. Unless you're, I don't know, unless you go through the research and... But I can remind you of Salman Rushdie, the most, let's say, the most superficial instance of his satanic verses, at least this is my feeling about it, is when he tries to write about Saladin Shamsha being made to eat his excrement in a police van, for instance. And there you're on dangerous ground. Rushdie himself hasn't been through this. He's trying to document it as closely as possible, and you somehow feel that right there he's not being his Rushdie best, no? That he's sort of trying to connect things in a way. This fact has to set us thinking, certainly. But I mean, other writers here could also have a go at this question.
Comment on that.
I would like to add something, because there's another dimension to the clandestine project, which is probably one of the most obvious dimensions, but hasn't been tackled because it wasn't the subject today. And that is sort of, in a way, a rediscovery of the Mediterranean and of its stories, which hasn't taken place. I mean, we live in right in the navel. We're supposed to be in the navel of the Mediterranean, but our educational system teaches us more about the British Isles, is what I studied, than about Algeria or about Sicily, for that matter. So in a way, it's also a very clear statement, which we also made recently when we organized an event to commemorate World Book Day, and we chose to translate Mediterranean writers rather than other writers. So in a way, it's also trying to reappropriate our Mediterranean stories, and hopefully this will be one of the many roads some of us will take, because of course it's a project which is completely open, and it couldn't be otherwise. Otherwise, I thought it would be a very interesting project, and that's also why we're working with Cypriot and Greek and Turkish Cypriots, Italians and Greeks in this project. Question at the back, and then perhaps we could finish off with Dr. Cremona.
Yeah, the boy, please.
Michael, that was Michael also. Sorry, and then we'll finish off with Michael, just for practical reasons.
I'd like to ask you, now that you are in Malta, how are you integrating yourself within this culture? I mean, a stranger in a strange land, and due to your parents' political status, you have these problems apparently with some of your other Congo people. Is there any institution, any person, even maybe among your people with whom you are discovering this new island, or with whom you are, and through whom you are maybe getting inside this new culture, inside Malta? How is there any cultural shock?
Yes, first talking, it was not much easy to integrate to Maltese community or culture. First, I would say is the language. Life problem of the language. That some of the friends, you know, you can be around like together like this, and they'll be talking Maltese. So, like, they don't care about you. And you'll be feeling like I'm disturbing them. I'll be asking something in English, they'll answer you, then they return back to Maltese. Talking, still continue talking Maltese. So later on, you just feel, maybe this is not my place. Maybe they are not, you know, my people or good friends to me. So maybe let me try somewhere else. And then you can try to the second one, the third one, the same thing. So better you find, just stay alone. And to bring some problem how to drain really Maltese culture or something like that. What you want to say?
Just one thing. Are there any refugees who maybe form a community for other new refugees with whom you can integrate?
Yeah. Among refugees, yeah. They still have like a fear between them. Because first, stay here in Malta. Yes, people, they are here. They accept them to stay here, but officially not. Officially no. Because each of person got his own case. Now, they used to be afraid that, maybe this one, we go talk bad about me. Because my case is not yet finished. You feel a fear that maybe this one will destroy me there. So they will deport me back. And each of us, we don't feel ready to stay together. Because few of people have been accepted. Few. For 2,000 something sick asylum they have asked in Malta. Few. I spoke to Andrea, just few. Now, most have been rejected. So even there is a lot of problems that between the refugees themselves, that my case is not finished, not yet. They're still studying my case. Maybe you will go talk anything about me wrong and I'll be subject of deport. So, you see, there is not really a union between refugees themselves. So they are not really staying together. Like, when we came out from the detention, they gave us one building in St. Paul's Bay. I'm telling you, they brought us out from that place because of troubles. All the time, quarreling. Troubles that mean that between just themselves, between refugees, that's how. Maybe you want to.
Was it true?
Sorry?
Was it true?
Yes. Troubles. Like between them, maybe you're going to talk about me there and United Nations will send me back. Maybe you're going to talk something like this, they will send me back. And they are afraid to stay together. They are afraid to stay together. That's maybe you accuse me on the wrong way. They will send me back. Just like this. And they are not staying together.
That's there's what no I can. Community inside. There's no community inside the detention center. You don't kind of aggregate together to maybe form some kind of solidarity together, at least inside.
You know, people, they are coming from different families. Different places, different cultures,
different languages,
and it's not much easy. And they have problems. That's what pushed them to come out from their countries, and their brand is not, you know. Like I remember one guy
just not because maybe they want to make trouble, you know, their brain is having too much problem and they don't think well again, they don't reason well again. One guy, they came to ask him, United Nations came to ask some question, because before come out, before have freedom, they have to know who you are, where you're coming from, what's your name, what about you. Today they come, they ask him, what's your name? My name is Jack. They wrote down Jack and okay, your birth date, give everything. And later, maybe 1 month later, they come again and they ask him, please, what's your name? Peter. My name is Peter. Say what? It's Peter? So, yesterday, last time you said you are John. Today you are Peter? Say, I'm sorry. No, what's going on? What's going on with you? So, where are you coming from? Now they start doubting even the country you are coming from because you don't tell them the truth. Later on, you see, you just call them and say, okay, please, sir, I want to talk to you. To an authority you want to talk to. He said, please, do you know I want to tell you something? Do you know your father? I say, what are you asking me? He said, no, because it's only your mom knows your father. Because it's the mom who's collecting pregnancy. He knows who's your father. So even you to know that your mother is, maybe it's not true. Maybe your father is virgin. It's all your mom knows. So I can tell you what I'm feeling. Maybe my mom lied me. So later on, they just think that they are not correct, you know, having a lot of problems, and they start, and there are some of the people really got mad.
Exactly.
Definitely got mad. In prison, detention, what? Got mad. His brain is torn up, completely.
Vikian, right. I'm really going to make a series of comments about the whole discussion, because I think it was an unequal discussion. In the sense, on the one hand, we had a very good, extremely good, actually, literary presentation of a present-day literary situation, and on the other, we had a presentation which is of another nature completely, and I don't think it's very fair to have linked them with the name of clandestinity. I mean, it's a completely different, we're talking of two completely different levels, and I think they have to be commented as two separate entities. I don't think we can provide a link between the two. So I do feel that we are a bit unfair here, because it's a sort of unequal situation. I mean, we're going to talk about a literary world, which is Norbert's, and a world which unfortunately is a very real one, and yet because we do not know it very well, sort of has almost literary proportions or imaginary proportions to us who are outside of it, on the other hand. So I that was the first comment I wanted to make, because I think it's important. Also, I think coming back, and I'm going to comment therefore separately on the two levels. Coming back to your question, Hadil, I think that it's important to note that first of all, when we come to, according to me, when we come to talking about literatures, in many cases, as has been said, it is very difficult to know of these literatures which recount these stories, maybe because they haven't arrived to Malta. I mean, internet has only happened 10 years ago, and before, so many titles never came to this country to start with. And I think that it is very difficult to tell people to recount something which they do not know a lot about. I mean, I think that clandestine arrivals in Malta were for a very long time actually hushed up by the press. So we didn't really know what it meant to be a clandestine or what it meant to come to Malta as boat people. We suddenly started waking. I can tell you, last year was the first time I experienced the coming in of a boat into Valletta, because I just happened to be near the port. I was about to dive and a boat had just been, I heard a siren going on and I was wondering what was happening. And I saw a police boat accompany a boat, and I think it's the first time I have genuinely ever seen a boat of refugees go anywhere. I mean, I'd never seen them before. So I think it's also a reality which we are not used to. I don't think anybody is, but we're still trying to get to terms with it and trying to understand what exactly it is. Also, remember that we have been bombarded by a lot of media in countries where this has happened before, and with all the prejudices of that media, apart from all the, you know, the people fighting for, I mean, there have been all this presented from the press. I remember all the Albanian arrivals in Italy and all the discussions on the Italian television. That somehow conditions you to look at the refugee problem. I think the fact of many refugees being rejected, unfortunately, is not only a Maltese truth. I mean, I went to a refugee camp in Latina, in Italy, a few years ago when we had when there was still Czechoslovakia and the Iron Curtain still existed. We helped a Czech doctor leave Malta and jump the plane, and he stopped in Italy. And I can tell you that conditions conditions in various camps, unfortunately, are not exactly qualifiable as respecting totally human rights. And I've just been to Cambridge for a few months, and I was very close to Oakington, and I can tell you that in Oakington, refugees are arrested. They live in a prison. It's Oakington prison, and the amount of rejections is incredible, sometimes for most incredible reasons. So unfortunately, and coming to that, I think what really made me reflect a lot is this culture of fear. I mean, I couldn't help but thinking, and I'm just thinking aloud here, of the culture of fear that we as men, and women anyway, cultivate. When you are so insecure, you are afraid of everything and everybody. And this is something I experienced when I visited the other refugee camp. I've never been to the refugee camp in Malta. But people were afraid to talk to each other because it's a sort of instinct of self-preservation. And it was something I had really lived over there. Because my friends had to live in we had kept them ourselves, but they had to live in the camp if they had to get a visa. And the fear was, I have very rarely seen, in my very little experience, refugees who sort of create a community, et cetera, because there is this fear of rejection and this fear of not being accepted and all the baggage of culture that they bring with them. It was interesting that you were talking about a Congolese problem, because I lived it on a Czech level, which was Europeans with Europeans. So it's not a question of race or color or creed, actually. It's a question of a necessity. People want to leave and they want to get somewhere else and they want to be recognized, and they are afraid of anybody who's going to stop them, even if that person is going to be. So I think that the question of integration, I think that also is questionable, because apart from you being a refugee in Malta, I think I have been in Spain, and I can't speak Spanish, and I've been with Spanish friends who will try to speak to me in English, but then will revert to Spanish. It's not very nice, I agree, and it's not very hospitable, I also agree. It's not the thing to do, I agree even more, but it's the thing that people do all over the world I think we have to, you know, say it. There's no two ways about it. Now, whether they're Maltese, Spanish, Congolese or whatever, that is unfortunately the way of the world. However, integration into a community, I think, is a more difficult process because everybody is afraid of the other, particularly when this other's origins are not known, when they are so suspect, when people, normal people, have been fed with so many ideas about who this other can be. And I have been in the privileged position where I have translated at ministerial conferences about immigration and migrants. And I can tell you that this fear runs across up to, I've translated ministers expressing exactly the same thing that lay people would express in perhaps less political terms. So, yes, there is a fear of accepting the other, particularly when you don't know if what he is saying is true, when there is no way of checking it, when all you have to do is believe. Now, there are some people who are willing to take the plunge and believe, and there are some people who are more reticent in believing. And there are some people who cannot even begin to imagine what the reality actually means. I mean, you know, what you recounted this evening, it had me cringing because I had never thought of the journey, the hiding, the boat, the fact of sitting crouched for 16 days. And you've set out a whole series of thoughts in me, which maybe I, not because I'm indifferent or because whatever, but because I honestly had never thought of them. And I think it's difficult. It's a difficult process that we're all going through to see how to negotiate living with this other, you know. And it doesn't happen from one day to the next. I don't know. I just wanted to make a series of comments and not ask any questions.
It was very important, what you say.
Mm-hmm. Last thing, I just want to say, no, but that was a really excellent paper, apart from everything else.
I wanted to add about something, like you said. It's true, there is a fear among people. But I've noticed something. It's coming from somewhere, the fear. I've noticed that when we arrived here in Malta, when they came, they welcomed us nice. They took words. Those people were not able to stand up themselves, straight to the hospital. They bring them back. They ask them, what's your name? Where are you coming from? Everything. Oh, you know, people, they relax. No, God, thank you. We found a land. And they are talking, you know, they are giving their details nice. What is their problem? Later on, they'll feel a pressure on them. And then they start asking questions between them. What is going to happen? And start asking questions between. What is going to happen? We don't know. We heard that they are deporting us back. Where are we coming from? Where? Just in Africa. No, but what should we do to be remain here? Oh no, but you have to prove you have a problem. But now, my case I've told them, means that they don't believe, so what should I do? My friend, add something, put something else again for what you said before. So they start changing what they've said before. And the fear took place. It's from pressure. Because before, it was nice. They'll come, they're talking nice with the police. With polite. Can you come sit down here? Yes, sir. You come sit down. Can you do this? Yes, sir. You'll do it. Because they know they're going to sit down. They're going to hear their problems. And they're going to help them. Later on, they'll feel pressure. But, sir, I'm not feeling okay. Who told you to come here? Did you find another country, just Malta? Oh, what's going on?
So I mean, these people hate us. And I know some of the people, they were trying even to contact Geneva from detention. You say, please, sir, I want to, can you help me? I want to contact my parent to come, or any relative to do something for me, maybe. Okay, I can go back easily, not the way you can send me. But maybe you lie the police. When they will go, you put the card and try to contact maybe somebody else. Okay, please, please, can you contact Geneva for me? Or contact Geneva for us. We are here, detained here. They want to send us back. And we don't know what we do. Why? They're feeling pressure on them. And it's pushing them to change what they told you before. Anyway, to find a way how to be remain here. And you'll see that fear will start. That they don't trust anyone anymore. Even the government here, even the police, anyone they don't trust anymore. So they will start telling you what even, just to find a way that you can help. That's what you can say.
Okay, there's Michael's last question, but before that, I would like to say something, and so will Norbert. Mine will be very short. When Paul and I originally came up with this proposal, came up with this idea of having this session, I think it was seen in the context of what the other sessions were going to be doing. So there was a session about the whole issue of refugees with Father Greg Margaret Marcia Grima, etc., etc. So the idea of this particular session, and I agree with you that it somehow didn't come together the way we had originally planned, but I'd like to say why, was, so let's not discuss the actual problem, which has been discussed already in other sessions. Let's talk about how we can narrate the stories that we're going to be hearing. But the problem is that the project is an open project, and it's not there to force people to do things. So the moment of the session didn't coincide with the moment of development, with the process, that's a better word, which was taking place within the clandestine group. And I felt I had to accept that. I mean, so the point of contact was supposed to be, and at certain moments it appeared here, but it wasn't the dominant factor, that's clear. And I agree that these were, I wouldn't say they were two papers of different levels. I would say they were in completely different realms. Yes, in other words, Norbert throughout much of his paper was talking about Motis literature, and Popo was talking about the experience of escaping from a country where he was personally in danger, like so many others.
May I just abuse the privilege of the microphone and also being one of the co-conveners to just throw in the point, Adrian, here, that there's a strange kind of bricolage going on here. There's every reason for being absolutely jarring and absolutely incommensurable sometimes. I mean, having listened to an extremely thoughtful and radical paper on Maltese literature, which courageously said exactly what it wanted to say in very precise terms, it's very jarring to be thrown into a situation where you're hearing about the unrepeatable violence, but you're seeing the currents and the global situation in which the Maltese island is now finding itself. We're seeing the absolute political parameter of Malta in the global economy and global politique at this moment in time. So in a strange, crazy kind of way, it's good that the two papers jar, because it throws into a very strange relief the very interesting things Norbert said. Sorry to throw that in.
And the final comment, which somehow, sort of a really brief comment, ironically, this session also in a way reflects what's happening within the clandestine group in the different countries, I would say, not only in the Maltese group. Basically, you have people who are writing about the writer as clandestine, about the writer as unauthorized, and you have other people who are sort of grappling with this with this narrative, which is far beyond them, but which they feel they must narrate somehow. So in a way, sort of the difficulty of putting these two together is also something that we in the clandestine
writing group are also facing. Norbertan and Michael too.
Okay. With regard to what Dr. Clow said, that's why people like Homi Bhabha are still so popular, even within criticism, because they come up with these, they are still aphorisms, but they are still also very relevant. For instance, Bhabha would say post-coloniality is the time of insanity, you know? I think that somehow this could relate to what Popol said about the conflicts between the refugees themselves. With regard to what Dr. Cremona said about unbridgeability, the issue of unbridgeability between different discourses almost, I feel that what Popol is saying is so unspeakably monstrous, that it simply doesn't get through. It simply doesn't get through. Like Dr. Kallous argued about September 11th, so unspeakably monstrous that theory could not handle it. In fact, you've got only Zizek and Arundhati Roy trying to meander their way. So sometimes even a clandestine, an asylum seeker, would be so traumatized, as the people in clandestine know, that there's no way he would relate his experience to you. So there's also a sense of mutedness in the whole thing. And when it does get through, like it did get through with Benjamin Zephaniah, for instance, if you go and tell Benjamin Zephaniah today and tell him, listen, Benjamin, what about the problem of asylum seeking? Basically, you'd be risking... anyway, he'd be very angry for sure. Because, and I can understand that, because it reaches him in such absurd proportions. Okay? He can't think of it as a problem. After all that, he can't think of it as a problem. And Zephaniah is a very good example. Why? Because he's a best-selling author, living in London right now, who's still suffering things like his cousin getting killed in the police station a few months ago. You know, so he's still sort of on both sides of the equation. So there's this sort of unspeakability. Spivak notoriously said the subaltern cannot speak. You can contradict her as much as you like, but I think ultimately we do go back to her square one, very unfortunately.
I'd like to address my question to Norbert. How politically effective can the excellent project listed in your paper be? How politically effective can the project elicited in your paper be?
May I ask something? What do you mean by politically effective here?
In the sense of sort of being marketable to the people at large, influencing public opinion, don't know, whatever.
If we're thinking in terms of, let's say, I'm envisaging a politics of Maltese literature in the future.
I mean not being limited to the literary community.
Yes, but again, there's the big issue of where are the limits of literature, or where should literature delve and where should it not? I believe that literature has every right to speak about anything, but then there is good literature and bad literature. This is the big who better question. Who better than Popol to narrate his experience? I do not feel to be in a better position than Popol to narrate that experience. But in terms of a politics of literature, as I said about the cosmopolitics of a Maltese literature, I hope that can very well happen. And I think that Maltese literature can be effective in that sense, as Arnold Cassola had argued in his introduction to the literature of Malta, an example of unity and diversity, you know, when he said that literature managed to do on paper what politicians didn't manage to do in their usual dealings, that it brought so many different and conflicting traditions to come together very effectively in a single language and in a single body of writing. So ultimately, I can see the political role of literature there. I am still very, very suspicious of statements like the political commitment of literature, or even the political effectivity of literature. I wouldn't like to find literature being taken, let's say taking relating politics to literature in, well, any way we like. Okay, I'm not presenting a perception of literature as something up there or anything like that.
Sometimes I think it's important to make a distinction between between literature as art and literary propaganda. Because if we are propagandizing and we are following a line, whatever in whatever medium we choose to do, we are actually, in a way, we're rigid and we continue. Art certainly is influenced by life. I mean, there is no doubt that it's not just a matter of looking at form and playing with it in whatever medium we take. But there is also the freedom of art, which is something which is the thing that we seek. You were talking in your paper about the ability for us to come out and to be free. Likewise, Popov was talking about freedom of the not as a concept or as an ideal, but as an actual reality. You know, if we're talking about using art to conceptualize this freedom, I think there we are really treading on very dangerous ground, because it means that there are those of us who have various prisons of our own, who have various sufferings, who need to surmount them and also be free. We cannot all have had the experience which Popol is talking about, but we can, as artists, use the experience of our own of our own life, our own nature, to fight for that freedom too.
Now, it is definitely not the commitment of literature, I believe, to change something in the realm of politics. But let me give you, Michael, a good example of political effectiveness of literature. Okay, the Ħalfa tal-Kittieba Maltin is an example of the political effectiveness of literature, because they've been writing into being something that is simply ramifying these ideas of nationalist identity, of patriotism. So in that sense, literature is also politically effective, but see what happens. So
I think I'd just like to say that there's one other connection that can be posed between these two talks, stemming from the question of Michael and the point made by Isabel. And it would be this: if Norbert is serious in arguing for a literature that doesn't matter, for a literature which tries to be invisible, if he's asking for a project of humility, one way of not merely achieving, but coming face to face with invisibility, not mattering, is the face of the kind of violence and the kind of insanity which Popol suffered and which many other people in the world are suffering to this day. So in a strange kind of way, not mattering, invisibility and humility are all projects for Maltese literature which can respond to the kind of statements which we've heard from Popol tonight.
Okay, I'd like to thank everyone for being here this evening. I'd also especially like to thank Paul and the other conveners of these works in progress. Dr. Cremon, Vicky Cremon and others. I think it's been a very good experience for me personally last week and also this week. They've both been very productive sessions, I think, very interesting discussions afterwards. And I think I must say, and I'm sure many of you would agree with me, that there aren't many places where you can have this kind of discussion in Malta at the moment. I mean, thank God for for the works in progress. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you to Popol, of course, and Norbert.
You have listened to the second and the final part of Articulating the Clandestine Experience, which was one of the seminars in the Work in Progress series. You have listened to Work in Progress, a series of seminars on understanding cultural diversity.
Thank you.